This is Scott Becker with the Becker's Healthcare Podcast. I'm excited today to be joined by Howard Kern. Howard's one of the best chief executive officers in the country. He serves as the CEO of a great regional system that's really more than a regional system today, a broad system, Sentara. Howard, can you take a moment and introduce yourself? Then we'll talk to you about priorities, the coronavirus, leadership, and more.
Scott, thank you. And first of all, you're being very generous with your compliments of me, and I want to return the compliment in saying how much I enjoy and appreciate what you do and the great organization you represent. I think we all very much enjoy the kind of publications and information you share, and thank you very much for the opportunity to be a part of your podcast. Let me start with a little bit of an overview of Sentara Healthcare. Sentara started back 132 years ago in 1888 as a nonprofit healthcare organization, ironically, in response to yellow fever epidemics that were plaguing Norfolk at that time because it was such a big shipping port. So a little bit of a ironic connection to what we might talk about a little bit later with this this novel coronavirus and COVID-19. And we have 12 hospitals today with almost 3,000 beds. And we have a health plan with soon to be 850,000 lives. We're in the middle of closing a transaction to partner and own a health plan that is currently owned by Virginia Commonwealth University in Virginia, which will take us up to about 850,000 lives. We have a great team of employees and do a lot in a variety of areas. And one other interesting thing I'll point out is we have an educational mission where we have our own College of Health Sciences and provide training, have bachelor's degrees for nursing and a number of other specialty areas, which is we find to be very helpful in our disciplines that we need to provide. So it's a very diverse organization and do a lot of interesting things.
We'll talk about that last one because It seems like as even prior to this coronavirus COVID-19 outbreak, in fascinating connection to the yellow fever and how Sentara was founded originally, it is this issue of the ratio of our population to our providers. Mm-hmm. So it seems like almost nothing is important now is this constant effort to mint more nurses, more doctors, more providers. Because even prior to this, we had a looming shortage and no one sort of listened to it. But now with something like this happening, it seems like everybody understands, oh my God, we've got a horrible shortage in the best of times.
Right.
But in a real challenging situation, it's really a debacle.
That's right. We worry about that. And the School of Nursing within our College of Health Sciences, we can ramp it up or ramp it down, which is a very helpful thing. And we have affiliations with the universities in the regional level. And of course, to meet the varying needs of our workforce, we affiliate with many different universities and training programs in nursing and other disciplines, as well as in medical education. But the beauty of this program is, I remember back to the recession of 2008 and 2009, we had been producing large numbers of nurses, and all of a sudden, when the workforce was overloaded, we had more nurses than we needed. We downsized our classes dramatically. We actually scaled them way down, but at the same time, the ones we were graduating, we actually kept in the workforce, even though we didn't officially need them, because we felt like we owed those people that coming out of our school a job, until we knew eventually the recession would wind its way down and we would have more specific nursing positions for a lot of those nurses. But the value of having that nursing school allows us to take it from one graduation class a year to two classes a year, and from 50 students per class to 100 students per class if we want. So it gives us the flexibility to really ramp up the pipeline.
In a fantastic thing, and the world and country are just going to need more and more caregivers. They already did, and now it's going to be just clearly exponentially so. I want to talk. talk today about leadership, because yes, you've done just a magnificent job of putting clinical experience and quality first at Sentara. It's really something that I find it shouldn't be so shocking.
Yeah.
But when you took over, you made such a reasoned, intelligent decision about this is how we're putting quality first and patients first, that it was a really sort of and you had previously great leadership at the institution, but how you sort of made this the singular focus, we're going to be a great quality, great patient experience, was to me positively inspiring and shocking. And talk about how you came to that as this absolute cornerstone focus of Sentara and how that has played out.
Well, Scott, you might remember an article that I actually published in your magazine, in Becker's Hospital Review, that was, what if Jeff Bezos ran Sentara Healthcare? And one of the things that I thought about, you know, that even before I wrote that article, and really I reflected on it a little bit and tongue in cheek in the article, was the notion that many organizations, and it's a nature of leaders in many structures, to hire people that are oftentimes like them, and in some cases not quite as good. Because they don't necessarily want to have people that are better than them show them up. And it's somewhat subconscious process. They don't realize they're doing it. I think there's a lot of research, social science research in this area, that sort of points to that culturally, that when you're hiring leaders and managers in organizations, the person doing the hiring will tend to hire somebody that's very much like them, which is interesting from a diversity point of view. You don't get much diversity of thinking, not to mention gender or ethnic diversity. And you get somebody that typically is just a little bit less effective as the person doing the hiring. And what I wanted and what I really focused on was hiring people that were hopefully much better performing. And what I felt was critical to my success, and I think really great executives do this, and you could look at in any number of industries and in and out of healthcare, the great leaders will hire executives that are incredibly effective below them. And, you know, certainly going back to even Abraham Lincoln and Doris Kearns Godwin's book about, you know, her characterization of the way Lincoln formed his cabinet. You want a diverse set of perspectives, and you want really dynamic leaders that really can engage and demonstrate that kind of point of view. So that was my focus as I took over, was to bring, I had an opportunity of quite a bit of turnover in the leadership team when I took over, just natural turnover, people retiring. And I used that opportunity to put together what I regard as a really phenomenal team. So when I look at the success of Sentara, I give them all the credit. The success of our organization is a function of the dynamic leadership team that I'm very privileged to have here and the great work that they do.
Well, thank you. And take us forward now. I quite frankly see, you know, Jim Collins does this discussion of different types of leaders, level one to level six.
Yep.
Level five would be a great leader, but still has a little bit too much of their ego involved.
Mm-hmm.
And then level six would be the ultimate leader, someone who's sort of a little bit more low key, but has brought in lots of magnificent people around them who are great leaders. And when I look at, you know, a couple of the great leaders in Virginia, yourself, Nancy Agee, Stephen Jones.
Nancy's a great leader. Sure.
But they're all examples of people that do this magnificent job of being, yes, they're very present, they're very much in the game, but they've made their case that the story's not about them. The story's about their organization and the people they're surrounded by. And that sort of brings you closer to what's been thought of in some of these writings as what they call a level six leader, someone who's not so ego-forward, but is their people-forward, just a little bit more low-key and understands greatness is not sevens hiring fives, but sevens or eights having eights, nines, and tens around them that can lead with them.
Right.
And I think you've done a great job of that. It's always been that, and the incredible focus on It's not all about mergers and acquisitions. It's not all about growth.
Right. That's not growing for growth's sake, for sure. Yeah.
And really about how do we deliver great quality and great patient experience. I've heard you resonate on that time and time again, and it resonates with me. The next question is, we're living in this time of this coronavirus.
Yep.
You're obviously in the front lines of it. You in the world that you're in, you also served in the front lines of the opioid crisis.
Mm-hmm.
Any comments on where this is going? And, you know, we all hear and know it's going to get worse before it gets mm-hmm. better. But is there any possibility that, you know, it you know, fades as a flu season? Are there any sort of optimistic perspectives that you could give us? And is it just sort of, you know, holding tight to see what goes on here?
I'm afraid that I don't have a dramatically optimistic viewpoint other than to say that we have a great healthcare system nationally. And I think, you know, the organizations we have nationally are preparing, have prepared historically well for this. I mean, all of us in the country have done a lot of work on national disasters, on all sorts of, you know, emergency preparedness. And we prepared for this kind of thing. And most of us have put in place, you know, our protocols for, you know, infectious disease task forces. And ours has been in place for several weeks now with the combination of infectious disease experts, our physician leadership, logistics experts, operational leadership, to make sure we're being proactive and focusing on what I've wanted them to focus on in three areas: safety for our patients, safety for our staff. I think what we clearly saw in China and other countries has been a serious concern for the caregivers, that they were, you know, in serious risk, and there was a lot of mortality amongst the physicians and caregivers. And then safety in the community. There's a lot of misinformation still in a lot of our communities. Access to screenings and access to testing, which is the biggest issue, I think, for all of us right now, is that we're still facing a severe shortage of test kits and access to timely testing for patients that have the suspected exposures or demonstrating symptoms. That's the real big concern. But we all are indicating, frankly, Scott, and this is the bad news side of it, we're seeing, I'm hearing from our infectious disease experts that we are on the infectious infection curve, the infection curve of Italy. So that is not a good news message. I'm not happy to say that, but that's what I was told this morning, frankly, by our infectious disease experts, that the U.S. is not on a good curve.
Well, and clearly, we know that if we're reporting that 1,700 people have this, we all know as we're starting to see cases in every hospital around, at least some, that we all know the lack of testing means that real number is tens of thousands, and mm-hmm. perhaps the best case scenario is that the true mortality rates are lower just because there's so many people that actually have this. For all we know, 50 million people have in this country.
Agreed.
And it's not even, you know, and we try very hard to be apolitical.
Right.
And what's fascinating to me about political leadership on either side.
Right. Yeah, I'm certainly not trying to go there with my comments. I'm just simply giving you a sense of what we're seeing in terms of the evolution of this thing.
I know you're not. What I was going to say is, what's amazing in terms of lack of political leadership on both sides is the president's not providing clear leadership on it. Might have been lucky that we kept people out a little bit longer than we did, might or may not have been, and it depends on flu season, stuff like that, but not providing what we think of as Winston Churchill type leadership.
Right.
And then on the other side, it seems that 90% of the talking is aimed at bashing him versus, you know, more leadership on either side, just saying, here are the three things we got to do. We have to test a ton more. We have to take care of our poor. We have to take care of our healthcare workers and providers.
Right.
But it seems like everybody can't help themselves but get into the political morass versus saying, here's what we need to do. Right. And it just is, it's really a shame in terms of leadership, and where I do see great leadership, because mm-hmm. you know, I am fortunate to get to talk to hospital leaders every day. I do see largely magnificent hospital leadership sort of ignoring all the political noise and yeah. trying to just get out in front of this and take care of their people
right.
and take care of their patients.
Yep, yep.
Well, and that's where I'm seeing great leadership.
Scott, the frustrating thing is that we bear all the brunt of frustration in the community when the state public health departments and the CDC can't provide the resources. And, you know, it's not their fault either, because they never had the resource to begin with in terms of ramping up. Ideally, that, you know, that should have been done, you know, 2 months ago around these test kits for coronavirus and COVID-19. That's in the past. We've got to deal with what we're dealing with today. The key issue, though, is the reality is we're not dealing with containment anymore. Now, we got to make sure our political leadership understand the containment scenarios are pretty much over. The virus is here in significant numbers, and logistically, we've got to deal with mitigation of the virus and the disease impact. I don't believe containment is a realistic option.
Right.
That's just me. That's just our. That's my opinion and our experts and specialists, you know, view of what they're seeing in our population.
Right. I mean, it might be some reduced spreading for all the social distancing and crowd
yeah.
control, which we're sort of
right.
doing in this country.
That's what we need
it
to be doing.
It might be some of that, but
yes.
but not true containment. And then I guess the next question is, you know, let's say the reality is our country needs 500,000 more respirators tomorrow.
Yeah.
A place to put those.
Right. That'd be nice.
In war efforts, they've been able to ramp up like that, but there's no clarity in how quickly they can actually produce more respirators
yeah.
and find
yeah.
places to safely put them.
Yeah.
Is I guess one
yeah.
of the great questions
yeah.
on this, besides clear testing to know exactly where we're at, just the clear metric of
right.
where we're at on it. Well, let
yeah.
me move to a different discussion, because this one can be so distressing.
Right.
Let's move to something
right.
more positive.
My point on containment, Scott, is more about trying to close borders and stop airline flights and all of that. Is I'm not sure that we're going to get a lot of benefit from that at this point. It's a little late for that. I'm just saying. And you know, I think we do need to have social distancing, and we do need to take high risk people and keep them from being in broad-based social settings, but I think the idea that we're going to close borders and that's going to save us is not practical at this point. And it may have a small benefit, but it's not going to be a major benefit for us.
Right. It seems like the earlier closing of borders might have helped with China, might not have. We'll
yeah.
see in history. We'll know.
Yeah.
The more recent closing of borders, you know, we
right.
all know that we probably have as many cases here as they do in these European countries or something like
right.
that. And that's me talking, not you as CEO.
But this,
of health
this is
and
a
stuff.
Tough, it's a tough situation. I mean, we can sit around and argue, you know, quarterback, you know, Monday afternoon quarterback, a lot of this, but this is a very difficult situation for everybody.
It really is. So let's take it to the next question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Your thoughts on improving the U.S. healthcare system. I mean, obviously, this whole thing, a pandemic sheds light on where there's some problems,
yeah.
clearly. But, you know, at the end of the day, we do have overall this unbelievably magnificent healthcare system, imperfect. It takes care of 325 million plus people, all kinds of conditions, an aging population. So I view it as the baseline is it may not be an A-plus health system, but certainly overall, the entire gestalt of it, an A and A-minus. We certainly need tons of more providers in this country. We did before this, let alone after this. What are some of your thoughts on improving the U.S. healthcare system? How do they make – is it opening more teaching hospitals, more places where people can become physicians in residency spots, more nursing spots? What are the thoughts on improving the U.S. healthcare
sure.
system?
Well, that's a great question, and I think there's multiple kinds of ways to look at that. I would start with a couple of core issues. First, I would think we need to continue down the path of building some standards, national standards on quality. that organizations need to be measured against and aspire to. And I think the CMS is moving in that direction. And I think that we just need to continue to do that. The clinical quality and serve in safety that really gives the providers some clarity, consistent understanding of how they're going to be measured, and it gives purchasers and patients better information from a consumer perspective on what they're buying and in terms of quality and safety of care. I think we're never going to get to consumer levels of decision making without more consistent national standards there. I think the other thing I would advocate in, I think that these notions of Medicare for all are just fraught with challenges and problems, the financing and the cost of them. But I think there are some interesting examples within Medicare that revolve around Medicare Advantage, where we could create more models that create and provide incentives to providers that are truly value-based, and structure those models not just in Medicare, but in Medicaid and in commercial, models that give providers more of a meaningful incentive to drive better value and better outcomes. And then it allows providers to structure models from the provider perspective that can deliver on value. The problem in today's environment, in my opinion, Scott, is that you can talk all you want about pay for value and organizing for value as a provider delivery model, but unless you have your own health plan in significant scale, you're not going to get significant engagement from payers or commercial business where they're going to significantly transfer the risk to you as a provider, where the significant value benefit will be shared. The payer wants to keep most of that for themselves. So I think there's got to be a model where the provider gets a significant opportunity, meaning the doctors and the hospital, to organize around a value-based model that says that to the extent you lower utilization and provide better outcomes, you benefit, and benefit from an economics point of view. Otherwise, it's just economic disaster for providers to try to drive value.
And what's
not done today.
What's really happened is, and obviously more and more people sort of get this, if you're talking about Las Vegas, the insurance companies are sort of the house.
Right.
So it seems like almost regardless of what happens, the house sort of wins.
Right.
Maybe with coronavirus and some horrible upticks in costs, they'll have to pay out a little bit more. But
right.
At the end of the day, they seem to be the house because so much of what they do is just managed anyways versus at risk anyways. And when they try and push down risk to the providers, be it a health system or a physician, a large
right.
physician group, whatever it is,
right.
it almost, again, is heads they win, tails you lose,
mm-hmm.
because there's some gain sharing, but there's
mm-hmm.
so much risk, in the old concept of, well, you'll get a bonus, nobody ever believes they'll get the bonus. I mean, it's
but
very similar to how physicians
I think
do.
The model that is a good example of this is Kaiser, where they have the scale of payer concentrated lives that they have been able to grow, and they can now challenge, transfer those lives into a delivery model that they also have that is driven largely to provide great outcomes, great quality, but do it in the most efficient manner possible. And they don't win unless they do that. And they've done it to such a great extent that when they go into the market, they generally have a 10-point advantage over traditional payers because their cost base from a provider point of view is so much better.
And so they really have sort of, most people have this divided system where you got the insurers on one hand, the hospital
yeah.
on the other hand, the hospital on the other side. I mean, they truly are integrated where the insurance and the hospital
yes.
are all together and it goes
mm-hmm.
back 50 to 100 years.
Yep.
And it's been very hard for other health systems to duplicate
it is.
That.
Yep.
But
even in our system, Scott, we we are building that model for our health plan, Optima, working with our provider side, but it's still a relatively small percentage of our total business. So what we have to do in our medical group, for example, is we have our medical group dividing into three pieces. We've got a hospital-based component of our medical group, which is hospitalists and anesthesia and other specialists that work in the hospital purely. You've got a volume-based component of the medical group that are predominantly working in a traditional model. And then you've got a value-based component of the group that is predominantly working with the health plan on Medicare Advantage and on other risk-based value models where the medical group can really drive. It's almost a different mindset. You need a different component of the medical group doing it because they function totally differently than the value-based, the volume-based group does. Does that make sense?
Oh, no, 100%. And I've seen health systems over time that have lived in this bifurcated world where they're sort of trying to do their very best on value-based care for their own employer
and over time, we need to gravitate the scale of our payer business to that value-based model, which is going to be inherently lower cost and better outcomes. But today, the volume-based group is like 85% of the total business, 90%. It's so much bigger because that's where the predominant business comes from.
And unfortunately, the overhead and maintaining these great systems in place, health systems, the staffing, everything, it's a labor-intensive business.
That's right.
Value-driven business, it's everything. It's an expensive business.
And if we were to just say we're just going to be value-based and we're just going to move everything in the other direction, we'd just be cutting our throats.
It would be cutting your throats, and what you would find, in particularly in a point of crises, whether it's this coronavirus, a huge flu outbreak, a different yellow fever, we would be short thousands and thousands of hospital beds and providers whenever that emergency happens. So it's how do you flex back up and down?
It's been a long-winded discussion to answer your question, but I think if we can get that kind of model evolved, I think we can really drive better quality and lower costs. We have a clinically integrated network model with our doctors and hospitals working together, lowering costs and improving quality. And we have a clear track record where they have kept our costs and our quality performing at a dramatically lower rate over time now, 4 or 5 years, than lower than the historical market average in our market, than the average for the entire market. And we have a number of employers that have benefited from that because they wanted to have that clinically integrated network as a part of their benefit plan through our health plan, Optima. And it's a simple matter of engaging the providers in a way that incents them to help drive better quality at lower cost and do it with data and information and an economic model that gives them some level. They're not looking to get rich off it. They just want to have some level of incentive for doing it. It doesn't happen by itself.
Absolutely. Howard, I want to thank you and I want to encourage you. You're one of the most thoughtful, grounded leaders I get a chance to talk to regularly. You've got just a very clear head on your shoulders. You understand the mission, which is to take care of patients, take care of our communities, take care of your providers. It's just always a pleasure to visit with you. I want to thank you
for
your time today.
Pleasure was all mine, and I appreciate you giving me a chance to be on the podcast.